The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Derek Dorch of the Diversa Group, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch. Derek walks you through how to win government jobs, effectively manage your government career, and best utilize government services. Every week on Fed Access, you'll learn about interesting federal agencies, workers, and careers. Fed Access provides you the access you need to succeed in the federal government. And now your host, Derek T. Dorch.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thank you for stopping by the show. We're always glad to have you. Today, we're going to be talking about an interesting agency that's been out there. I would call them, say, SAM HSA, but they're called the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. They're a unique agency up in the D.C. area, but their impact is really, really great around the whole nation and everywhere else. And they do a number of different things in terms of really kind of helping people deal with substance abuse, looking at mental health issues and helping people cope with certain things, and also dispelling the myths of mental health and substance abuse and really trying to get people back on track. We're talking to the principal deputy administrator. Her name is Kana Inamoto, and I want to make sure I got her name right. So, Kana, if I make a mistake on the name, please correct me at any point in time. But I want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you very much, Derek.
And then we also have with her, we've got Caitlin White, which is a public health advisor, and she's on Kana's team. And we're going to be talking about a number of different things about the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration today, and really the discussion of how do we make sure that people are getting the right services and the right treatment and the right care that they need in order to be productive members of our society. Kana, talk to us about your agency. I mean, you know, it's really a unique agency, and I want to kind of make sure people have the website. It's samhsa.gov. But tell us about your agency and what's going on with you guys.
Thanks so much, Derek. So SAMHSA is a small agency within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. We're an operating division. Our sister agencies are the National Institutes of Health, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Food and Drug Administration. We have responsibility for reducing the impact of substance abuse and mental illness on America's communities. We're $3.7 billion and four centers. We have Center for Mental Health Services, Center for Substance Abuse Prevention, and a Center for Substance Abuse Treatment, and then a Center for Behavioral Health Statistics and Quality. We really have a very broad charge looking at people with serious mental illness, children with serious emotional disturbance, and people with and at risk for substance use disorder, as well as a broad responsibility for doing things like preventing substance abuse among young people or underage drinking, drug use, as well as preventing suicide and promoting mental health and wellness for all populations.
You know, I was looking at your strategic initiatives and really kind of increasing one of that really kind of, you know, pulled out to me and just in even talking, you know, I have a background in counseling. But and so when I saw your agency, I was really, really interested in what you're doing, the resources you're putting out. But one of the strategic initiatives you talk about is kind of definitely increasing the awareness of mental and substance abuse orders. And, we've got a number of different things right now, especially on the news. You hear about mental health all the time, and that goes with a number of different things, whether it be some shootings or other things. But there's some myths out there that if people have mental health issues, then, you know, those are the people who are more prone to violence, or those are the more prone to doing certain things. And that's not true. What is the truth, Kana?
Well, what most people don't realize is that mental illnesses cover a broad range of conditions. So anything from ADHD, depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, obsessive compulsive disorder, anxiety disorder. So all of these things are part of the spectrum of mental illness, and those are all on a continuum. So people have different levels of being affected. And so at any given time, one in four Americans meets criteria for a mental disorder. And what we know is that while there is a small segment of people most likely with psychotic conditions who are not receiving treatment, also those are very vulnerable if they are also abusing substances, there is a segment of people who are more vulnerable to violence. But overall, less than 4% of all violent acts that are documented in America are attributable to people with mental illness. So people with mental illness are far more likely to be victimized or victims of violence rather than to be perpetrators of violence.
You know, when we look at those kind of issues and we look at, you kind of mentioned the one in four, do we find that many people are not getting help, the help they need? And I know even on your website, you have an area that talks about getting help. Are we finding that many people are sometimes running away from getting the help because of stereotypes?
Absolutely. Part of it is negative attitudes or fears of sort of social concerns of what people will think about them. Some of it is that people don't think they can afford care. Some people don't know where to get care. But you're right, about 50% of people with a mental disorder aren't getting the treatment that they need. For substance use disorders, it's between 70, 80, 90% of people are not getting treatment, even though they meet criteria for a substance use disorder. So there's a huge need for shows like yours and for others to sort of share the message that, you know, mental illnesses and substance use disorders are treatable conditions. These are health conditions, medical conditions, like any other conditions, where we should be encouraging people to seek care, to be on the lookout for their health, to see if they are experiencing ill health. To talk to a doctor, to talk to a friend, a colleague, a professional person who might be able to direct them to help that is available, because we know that treatment does work. And there are lots of evidence-based treatments available. And that in the long term, we can support people to live really full lives of recovery once they have achieved a state of wellness. And or there are some people who will have a condition that they'll have to manage in the long term, like any chronic condition. And so complete remission may not be possible for everyone, but a state of recovery, a state of sort of fulfilling what your own personal goals are and having meaningful relationships and meaningful roles in life, we think that's possible for everyone.
You know, as you look at the resources that are out there and also even just the education of those who are maybe, you know, doctors, general practitioners and others, is the education where it needs to be, that maybe doctors who are talking to a person and may not be a mental health professional, but they're, you know, referring people to the right places? And also, are you seeing that we have enough mental health professionals out there, people who are trained to deal with this? And also even, and I'll jump into the substance abuse, because we're seeing prescription drugs, we're seeing all these things on the rise. Are there enough professionals to handle all the different issues that are going on out there?
So that's a two-part question. The first part is the professionals, the primary care professionals, the other health professionals with whom we partner and upon whom we rely so much. There are many, many fantastic healthcare systems, primary care systems, physicians, nurses, physicians assistants, and others who are doing great work in the primary care or other specialty care settings, screening, diagnosing, and treating their patients with mental illnesses or substance use disorders, and we really appreciate and rely on that collaboration. At the same time, we know that there are far too many primary care professionals or other specialty care providers who don't feel comfortable screening or diagnosing or treating behavioral health conditions. And so there is a lot of work that can be done. SAMHSA is trying to do much of that work, trying to educate within medical schools as well as other health profession schools on how to identify and treat substance use disorder, for example, as well as other aspects of where primary care and mental health and substance use intersect. On the part of the behavioral health workforce, absolutely, we are one of the leading workforce shortage professions.
Mm.
So a recent report by the Health Resources and Services Administration and SAMHSA indicates that by the year 2020, if we keep the same trajectory we're on, we'll have a shortage of 10,000 social workers and 10,000 school counselors. I think we'll also have huge shortages among psychiatrists and psychologists and addiction counselors. So everywhere you look across the behavioral health workforce spectrum, we are projecting really tremendous shortfalls, considering the prevalence of these conditions, now the ability to pay for care under the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act and the Affordable Care Act. People have more access than ever to insurance benefits that will cover treatment for mental and substance use disorders, and yet our workforce falls far short of what we anticipate the need and the demand to be.
You know, we got to take a quick break, but I want to jump back into, you know, what you're just talking about both the acts, about people understanding what the law is that provides them actual access to more care, but then also really kind of get into why are we experiencing this shortage? I mean, what's going on, especially when there's such a prevalent need for this? Is it the salaries? Is it, you know, what's the hurdles or the obstacles that are really preventing us to have the right kind of people doing this right kind of work that's very, very much needed? We've got to take a quick break. We're talking about SAMHSA. It's the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. You can find the website at basically SAMHSA.gov, okay, SAMHSA.gov, but you can just type it in and look under mental health, under government and everything else, and it should come up, but under Google or anywhere else. But it's a great site, a number of different resources on there for a lot of different people. We're talking to the principal deputy administration, Kana Inamoto, and we're also going to be talking to Caitlin White, which is her public health advisor. She's going to be coming on a little bit later because they're using technology in a number of different ways, some apps and web technology and everything else to try to get this message out, try to get services out for people who have issues with substance abuse or mental health to try to make sure they get the help. We'll be right back after this break. Listen to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we have been talking about mental health. We've been talking about substance abuse, and we've talking about the government agency who deals with these issues and these problems, trying to make sure Americans get back on track, trying to make sure that people get the care they need to deal with certain kind of issues so they'll be productive members of our society and not have to always deal with all these situations in life. We're talking about SAMHSA. It's actually the name of it. It's the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. You can find the website at SAMHSA.gov, which is SAMHSA.gov. So SAMHSA.gov. I want to make sure the website gets out there because there's a number of resources on there for everybody, not only people who are dealing with certain, you know, situations, but maybe family members, also for people who are in the medical profession who need to educate themselves about mental health, and a number of other people in law enforcement, everywhere else, they can educate themselves about the mental health and substance abuse issues in order to help that make sure you get people the right help they need. We're talking to the principal deputy administrator, Kana Inamoto, and we also have Caitlin White, which is her public health advisor. She's on the line as well, and we're talking about all these different issues. And kind of, you know, when we were talking about this, you mentioned about this workforce shortage, and that really is concerning because, you know, we've got all these Americans, like you mentioned, 1 in 4, who may be dealing with certain things and at different periods of time, whether it be depression or long-term situations or whatever. Why are we having this workforce shortage? What's going on? Is it pay? Is it, you know, training? What is it?
I think it is a range of issues, just like you've touched on a couple of them, pay, training. Until recently, mental health providers, substance use disorder providers, and their services were reimbursed at different rates or reimbursed less often or not reimbursed at all by third-party insurance. And so we're really grateful that the president signed into law in 2008 and Congress had passed the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act. That is a law that made it so that insurance companies had to cover mental health and substance use disorder benefit services on par with medical surgical benefits. And in 2010, when the president signed the Affordable Care Act, that strengthened and broadened the reach of parity. We call it mental health parity or mental health parity and addiction equity. That made it more in a broader range of insurance plans. And so about 170 million Americans, so half of all Americans now have increased access to an insurance benefit for mental health or substance use disorder treatment services. And until then, though, those services were not necessarily reimbursed by insurance. And so providers were not reimbursed at a very high level at all. And so that created less incentive for people to go into these fields. There was a study some time ago that showed that a master's degree counselor in a community mental health center got paid the same as a manager at a fast food restaurant.
Right. Right, right. You know, when I came out of school getting my master's in counseling, I remember the time when looking at the field, it was not a very high paying field. And I don't want to date myself too much, but it was a while ago. But, you know, it was always tough. I mean, whether it be school counseling or whether you were working in a substance abuse facility or wherever, you really were not getting paid that much. And from what I'm hearing, the salaries have not, it doesn't seem as if it's been this major shift in terms of an increase in pay. Is that what we're saying?
We're hoping that with parity, as well as a new law, Excellence in Mental Health Act, or 223, Section 223, which is creating a certified community behavioral health clinics.
Okay.
It's a demonstration program right now, but it will allow for behavioral health services to be reimbursed at a higher rate, similar to what gets reimbursed at community health centers. And we think that these kinds of innovations, delivery system reform, payment reform, because we know and we have confidence that behavioral health providers are delivering value, they are delivering outcomes for people that are cost-saving for the nation and for the health system, we feel like these kinds of innovations in payment reform will help, will show up down the road and increase salaries for our providers. At the same time, I think you've noted it also, is that we have to deal with negative attitudes and social perceptions. It isn't the easiest work. It does take a certain personality, a certain passion, a certain commitment to want to work with these populations. At the same time, it's incredibly rewarding work. But I've heard physicians who say, well, when I become a buprenorphine waived provider, if I start treating people with opioid use disorder or people who are have addiction, my fellow physicians treat me differently. They start to be prejudiced towards me. And so that carries over. And I think people think, well, I want to be a social worker, but I don't want to deal with that population.
Right.
I think what we have to help people understand is that these are health problems like any other health problems. We would never say, oh, well, you're the cancer doctor or you're the diabetes doctor. You know, we have to respect and understand the value of everyone's life and that every health condition deserves to be treated on par with every other.
You know, I want to come back to that in a minute. I want to bring Caitlin in. Caitlin, you know, you kind of deal with the you know, in terms of your role as public health advisor, but you're very much about technology. And I know you mentioned the blog, and tell us about, you know, the blog, and also tell us about some of the technology tools that you're, you know, involved in terms of educating people about these things.
Thanks, Derek, and thanks for having us. A lot of what Kana has been talking about what we do here at SAMHSA is really very personal. And what we have established is a number of social media channels that sort of take the work we do here at SAMHSA and give it a personal face, a personal voice, and use that opportunity to let people know what sorts of resources are available to them. So when I say social media, we have an active presence on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, in addition to having a blog. And we use these resources as one of our vehicles to get out timely, accurate information and data to make sure people have quick access to our resources, which range from treatment to immediate crisis counseling support to recovery support systems. And make sure they have access to that when they need it as a conversation is happening in the social media sphere. So in addition to our social media channels and our website, which you discussed, we have a number of mobile applications ranging in topic and audience from bullying to suicide prevention. So if you want, I'd be happy to talk a bit about
Let's go over, because, I mean, you know, what you're talking about are some of the most, you know, critical needs. I mean, we hear about bullying all the time. We hear about suicide all the time. We hear about all of these critical issues, and it seems to not be something that's going away. It seems to be something that we're dealing with more with social media and a number of different things, the pressures on these young people and pressures on all people. I mean, what are some of these tools that people can maybe download in their phones or they can get access to that may give them something, a sense of hope, a sense of, you know, hey, listen, I can get these resources right away.
Absolutely. One of the apps I want to start with is our Suicide Safe app. And you and Kana were just discussing workforce, and one of the points that was brought up was ensuring that primary care providers have a basic understanding of behavioral health, of some of the signs and symptoms, warning signs and risk factors for their patients. And Suicide Safe aims to do just that. So one of the more sobering statistics we have is that over about 45% of people who died by suicide had seen their primary care provider within a month of their death. And to us, that highlighted the critical need to make sure that primary care providers had a basic understanding of some of these warning signs and risk factors in their patients. And thus, Suicide Safe was born. So this app basically takes some of our suicide prevention resources, and in particular, a resource called the Safety. It's an approach to suicide screening, brief intervention, and then referring their patients to further treatment. I think one of the things that I heard Kana describing, we're not advocating that primary care providers necessarily implement a treatment, but that they have the resources to identify if further treatment is needed by a behavioral health specialist or professional. So Suicide Safe is basically to do just that, assess suicide risk among patients and help communicate with patients and their family and then refer them to the appropriate treatment resources. But that one is more focused on practitioners or clinicians. We have two other apps that are really targeted towards supporting parents and equipping them with resources they need to support the behavioral health of their children. So one is called No Bullying. And this app is basically designed to help parents, caregivers, teachers, and other service support providers who interact with children and youth resources, information, and basically equip them with the confidence that they need to start and maintain a conversation with their child about bullying. This app includes everything from conversation starters to, warning signs and resources for bullying, for whether your child is exhibiting bullying behavior or is being bullied. And one of the greatest resources or ones that people have been really pleased with of this app is it has a alarm feature where you can set an alarm to remind yourself it's time to talk with your child about bullying.
Austin. Hey, Kaylin, let me hold you right there because we got to take a quick break real quick. I mean, you've got so much. And this is, the reason I didn't want to stop you, because this is something that people need to hear. They need to hear about these apps. I mean, bullying, when we're talking to our young people, if an app can help somebody, deal with bullying or either stop the whole practice of it or suicide, then we want to make sure people get this. And I want to make sure that on the next piece that we tell people where they can get these apps at so they can download them off of either Google Play or on iTunes or wherever the case is. But we want to make sure they get the resources in their hand. We're talking about substance abuse and mental health. We're talking about SAMHSA. We're talking about the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. We've been talking about two great people who are working on this. We've been talking about Akana Inamoto. She's the principal deputy administrator, and Caitlin White. She's a public health advisor who's working on the technical aspects of building applications and technology to help people really get the help they need. They're going to be right back with me when we get this break. We'll take a quick break, and we're going to keep on talking about these critical issues. There's so much more to talk about the data, about what it's showing us, about more applications that people can use to help them out. We'll be right back after this break. Listen, Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you just joined us, we have been having an important conversation about substance abuse, about mental health, and about how to deal with these issues. And we're talking to the government agency who's been tasked to really deal with these important issues and issues that are very, very prevalent in our society. We're seeing it more and more every day. We're seeing more substance abuse, and it's not just of other drugs that are illegal drugs, but we're seeing prescription drugs. We're seeing a number of different things that are going on in our society. We're seeing seeing mental health issues, and we're trying to break the stereotypes about mental health, about that, you know, people who have mental health issues are violent and stand up. That's not the case. But all of us at some point in time may be dealing with something, and we have to find out how to deal with those issues appropriately, how to get the right help, how to find the right people who can really get us back on track. And we're talking about that right now, about finding the right resources and looking at the data in order to analyze it so that we can better use that data to bring in new prevention methods. We're talking to Akana Inamoto. She is the principal deputy administrator of the SAMHSA. And we're talking to Caitlin White. She's the public health advisor at SAMHSA as well. And she works on the technical aspect, the technology, and using apps in order to get information into not only the public, but also the people who are providers as well. Kind of when we were, you know, talking before, Caitlin was mentioned about these suicide apps and all these other areas. And I know as I'm looking at your website, you've got a number of different things, especially off the front page. You've got the suicide prevention line. What is that about? And, you know, even me, I'm a veteran. I served in the Marine Corps, and we've got a number of different veterans now who are dealing with, you know, suicide. We hear about it all the time. And we also hear about suicide with a number of different people. What do you have going on with this suicide line?
Well, first, Derek, thank you very much for your service, the sacrifices and the honor that you did to the country by serving is valued by everyone at SAMHSA and by so many of our fellow Americans, because without you, we wouldn't be able to maintain the lifestyle that we have. And SAMHSA absolutely wants to be in support of service members, veterans, and their families. We know that right now about 22 veterans die by suicide each day. And each one of those lives is a tragedy to lose to a condition that we know is preventable.
That's right.
You know, we are partners with the VA on their Veterans Crisis Line. We know that the majority of callers to that line are men who are older men in their 50s, 50 to 59, as well as some active duty service members and younger veterans. We know from the more recent engagements that we've had in Iraq and Afghanistan, between 30 and 50% of those veterans are dealing with a mental disorder, meet criteria for mental illness, either PTSD, depression, anxiety disorder, what have you, and about a fifth of them, or 1 in 10, have been diagnosed with SUDs with substance use disorders across the board. That number is double for those who have a mental illness. So if you have a mental illness, you're twice as likely to also have a substance use disorder if you are a veteran. And so we know that there's a lot that can be done to support that population, their families, help them get services. And so we're pleased that our National Suicide Prevention Lifeline offers a press one if you're a veteran or active duty to get routed to the Veterans Crisis Line. At the same time, we know that there are millions of Americans also who have concerns, who've never served in the military, but who also have concerns around suicide. And in fact, suicide is a leading cause of death for young people under the age of 17. And so we know that suicide is absolutely preventable. It is contributing. Suicide, drug overdoses, and chronic liver disease are actually contributing to increased mortality among middle-aged Americans. So we're seeing our population dying younger than you're seeing in other countries and other developed nations.
And these are all preventable, right? I mean, we're not dealing with something that we can't deal with. This is all preventable stuff, right?
Right. Absolutely. And so if you are... or a loved one have a concern, you think someone may be at risk for suicide, or you're feeling that you're experiencing thoughts of suicide, we encourage you to call 1-800-273-TALK. And I can get you what those numbers are, because I know now.
I got it right in front of me. It's 1-800-273-8255. That's the number, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And if you don't mind, I'll just give you the website, suicidepreventionlifeline.org. And for your veterans out there, team, they run the Veteran Crisis Lifeline, which is veterancrisisline.net. Another piece on there that you can kind of get access to these things, but 1-800-273-8255. And kind of what you said, just press what?
if you're a veteran, then you press 1, and that gets you to the Veterans Crisis Line, which is run by our partners at the VA, but we're really happy to be supporting that effort.
And then for other people like teens and young people and everything else, there are parts on the line that can direct you no matter what stage of life you're in. There are people right. who are on that line that you can press that button and kind of get the help you need.
Right. You don't actually have to press anything, I think, and you can get routed to a crisis center near you. At times, very high call volume, sometimes you'll get routed to a crisis center at some other part of the country, but the line tries very much to get people routed to a crisis line so that you'll get a trained, informed counselor who will be able to talk to you about resources and opportunities near you.
And I was just reading that you have your, at your own agency, you have your own national helpline, right? I mean, you guys are running your own kind of routing service where you're listening to things and maybe kind of triaging people and really trying to direct them to the right places?
Right. We do have a treatment locator. It's 800-662-HELP, 800-662-4357. And so we get thousands of calls every month of people interested in finding help for themselves or for a loved one.
And with the online piece right there, I saw that there's this online kind of a behavioral health and treatment service locator. I mean, do you have places on the site that you can direct people to get treatment, and whether it be substance abuse or whether it be mental health issues?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you just called it out. I don't know if Caitlin wants to add anything on that.
No, just that one of the unique features of the Behavioral Health Treatment Services Locator is, in addition to, you know, the general topic, mental health or substance use, you can drill down a little further. Kana mentioned data waived physicians. You can drill down to find, you know, opioid treatment programs or physicians who are licensed to prescribe buprenorphine for opioid use disorder. So that is our online treatment locator service, yes.
Outstanding. One other thing we've been dealing with a lot we see a lot, of course, disasters are always, you know, prevalent in our society. And those are, whether it be, you know, acts of God or you know, hurricanes or tornadoes or acts of terrorism or things like that. What's this disaster distress services that you're providing to different people who are sometimes, and do we see that there becomes a lot of mental health issues or substance abuse issues, you know, after disasters? Are we seeing data that says that, you know, we can maybe help people right when it happens in order to avoid people kind of maybe spinning out of control?
Absolutely. So we know that stress and anxiety and other sort of mental health type of symptoms are common reactions after any natural or man-made disaster. And so we have a number of programs that provide psychosocial services and supports to people in the aftermath of a disaster or an emergency situation. One of the resources that we have is the Disaster Distress Helpline. That's 800-985-5990. It's the Disaster Distress Helpline, 800-985-5990. And that is a 24/7 resource, which is confidential and multilingual and provides crisis support service to residents who are experiencing psychological distress as a result of a natural or human-caused disaster. You know, we have, unfortunately, tragedies like the one that occurred in Orlando recently, and we are getting calls and texts on that line for people who are needing some support or needing to know where to find resources in their area because they're concerned about themselves or a loved one. SAMHSA also has a Disaster Technical Assistance Center. We provide technical assistance to states and communities to help them and their behavioral health systems to respond to the needs of their citizens, because we know that sometimes the emotional and psychological toll can be even greater than the financial strain or the damage to physical items when you've lost loved ones or a way of life that is so central to who people are.
Kind of, let me ask this question, because it seems as if, you know, we always have these kind of go teams, right? These people who respond and for disasters or, you know, like Orlando's or things like that. You know, we always have teams that go down and whether, you know, you've got, you know, search and rescue teams, you've got other teams, you've got the medical teams. Are there mental health teams that are kind of the that get on the scene and can really kind of help with these kind of situations? I mean, is that something that you do or something that you support with the DTAC, with the Disaster Technical Assistance Center? How does that work?
Actually, we absolutely do support the Commission Corps and the Public Health Service, which is headed up by the Assistant Secretary for Health and the Surgeon General within HHS. And they have a corps that is thousands of professionals strong that provide that are able to be deployed in the case of a disaster. They have medical teams. They have engineering teams. They also have mental health teams. And we're proud that many of our SAMHSA employees are members of the Commission Corps who are also who also serve on those mental health teams. But SAMHSA doesn't staff those directly, but
right.
through the Public Health Service and the Surgeon General's Commission Corps.
It seems as if that's something that we may have to even look at even more about having mental health, you know, special teams, you know, and going from there as we look towards the future of going forward. We've got to take a quick break. We're going to keep this conversation going. There's so much that we've got to talk about. SAMHSA has so much going on, and we want to kind of talk about some of their programs and campaigns. There's some other websites that we need to get out there because there's really a number of people who need this information, and they can use it right away and maybe hopefully they can help somebody, you know, get off something or help somebody, you know, prevent a suicide or something like that if we get the right information to the right people and go from there. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch from Federal News Radio. We're talking about substance abuse and mental health, and we're talking about SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration. We're talking to the principal deputy administration, Kana Inamoto, and we're talking to Caitlin White. She's the public health advisor at the organization. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch from Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch from Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we have been talking about some important issues in our society. We've been talking about substance abuse, and we've been talking about mental health. We've been talking about how to deal with it. We've been talking about the government agency who's been tasked to really look at it, to how to deal with it, put solutions in place, to provide, you know, technical tools to help people, the providers, the mental health providers, the doctors, the law enforcement officers, those who are maybe facing people who were dealing with substance abuse and mental health issues, and try to make sure that we really try to not do harm, but we try to do good to help people get back on track and then go from there. We're talking about SAMHSA. SAMHSA is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, and we're talking to the Principal Deputy Administrator, Kana Inamoto. She is a person in charge of this agency and really been tasked to really push this agency to really provide the services and support and everything else to the local locals and the states and all the others and really get services out to the direct people as well. And we're talking to Caitlin White. She's a public health advisor. She is working on a number of different issues. You know, ladies, we were talking over the break about the opiate use right now and what's going on right now. Is it the overprescribing? We've seen to have this just really, really massive outbreak of a number of people who are now addicted to prescription or opiate use drugs. What's happening right now?
Yes, Derek, we are now seeing an epidemic of opioid overdoses across the country, there are more drug overdoses than there are deaths by traffic accidents.
Mm.
So if you think about that, and there are many times more drug overdoses than there are homicides in this country. So we have a lot of work to do, and we know that the majority of people who are current heroin users started at some point with a prescription drug problem. And so we do see prescription drugs, the overprescribing of opioids for pain, as a gateway problem that has led to this crisis across the country. And yet the sad thing is we're seeing people dying, and we know there are things that we could be doing not only to prevent addiction but also to prevent the overdoses.
When we look at this, is it a matter of, you know, when people are getting prescribed these painkillers and other things like that, is it the prescription, is it the provider that's not educating? Do we need to do more on the education front? Do we need to have somebody who's monitoring how people are doing? I mean, how do we deal with this in order to prevent this?
You know, I think the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Sylvia Burwell, has made it one of her top priorities, together with the President, to address this opioid problem. The first prong of the HHS initiative is to improve prescribing practices.
Mm.
So right now, the United States uses the vast majority of the world's prescription opioids, even though we are a small minority of the world's population. And there are about 300 million prescriptions for opioid medications written every year. That's enough for every man, woman, and child to have a prescription in their medicine cabinet. That is way too many opioids. And some of this came from policy changes where quality systems started counting pain as the sixth vital sign, and so doctors were measured by how well they helped patients manage their pain. And then at some point there was some marketing of some of these medications that said that if they were prescribed for pain, they were not addictive. But we know now that that's not true. Many people who now are suffering from an opioid addiction, heroin addiction, started because they were first prescribed an opioid for pain. And so we feel strongly that we need to improve prescribing practices. We have over 60 medical colleges that have signed on to a White House initiative that they would provide the coursework on treatment, prescribing of opioids for pain to medical students so that we wouldn't see this problem in future generations. We also have quite a few efforts going on training physicians, and the Centers for Disease Control has issued guidelines, prescribing guidelines, and our own agency has a physician clinical support service for prescribing of opioids. There are a lot of resources out there for docs and nurses, PAs who are prescribing opioids, dentists as well. We also need to educate the public on how to dispose of their opioids appropriately, their medications, because keeping them in their medicine cabinet puts them at risk for diversion, that someone will use them for the wrong purposes and create problems that we really don't want to see. The other thing we have to do is increase access to a life-saving medication called naloxone. Mm-hmm. Naloxone is a medication that reverses the respiratory depression effects of an opioid overdose. But you can't use this medication unless you have it available to you at the time that you need it. And so we really are doing a big effort, a push across the nation to increase access in states and communities to naloxone. And thirdly, we need to increase access to medication-assisted treatment. We know that opioid use disorder is treatable. There are a number of FDA-approved medications for opioid use disorder. SAMHSA supports increasing access to all three of those medications. There's buprenorphine, which Caitlin mentioned earlier, methadone, which is a dispensed medication from an opioid treatment provider, as well as naltrexone, which is an oral formulation as well as a long-acting injectable formulation. These have different mechanisms of action, but we know that they can reduce cravings, they can increase people's ability to maintain their jobs, stay with their families, and stay out of the criminal justice system and stay healthier and avoid things like injection drug use, which increases their risk for HIV, hepatitis C, and other problems.
Kind of real quick, got about maybe 20 seconds. Any website you want to get out there that people need to know about?
I want to make sure people know about findtreatment.samhsa.gov. findtreatment.samhsa.gov, and you can find a treatment provider for you or a loved one.
Thank you so much. We're going to have you back because we didn't cover half of the stuff that we were supposed to cover today. And there's so many different things that you have out there. I want people to make sure they know about the website, SAMHSA.gov. Please make sure you go to the site. There's a number of different resources. Kind of mentioned all the different defined treatment piece. Caitlin mentioned a number of different apps you can download from, I think, the store SAMHSA.gov. You can get different apps on a number of different bullying, disaster, suicide, and then for all the people, suicide hotlines and everything else, whether it be a veteran, whether it be a young person, whatever stage you are in life. Please make sure you call the numbers, go to the website, get the help you need, and then go from there. Kind of if you don't mind, we're going to have to come maybe in a couple months, definitely have you back and continue to have this conversation, because I think this is something we want to make sure we keep in the forefront of the public.
Thank you so much for that. We really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.